continue to the Adriatic. Any luck and we'll find each other in Brindisi. And take our time, rounding Spain. Let things cool off. I'll be travelling with a crate of feathers, of course. She did not look pleased. How long do you mean to take? He shrugged, his eyes small in the gloom. He wanted her to say something that she was not saying, but he did not understand it. They had made no promises, he knew. Does it matter? He said.
I imagine not.
He looked at her, and she met his eye, and they stood like that in the silence. The hotel felt very still.
Give it 3 months,
he said, hesitantly. And then,
you'll reach Brindisi before me. Be patient. Look for me at the Adelphi. The Adelphi? On the harbour front. I'll be there.
She pressed a hand to his cheek in the gloom. She was holding something sleek and warm, and when he took it from her, he saw it was a small opal brooch. He stepped away from her and held it up to the window. The delicacy of its filigree, the fine lace-like twists of gold in their making.
It belonged to my mother, she said softly. Martin gave it to me when he brought me out of the workhouse. I asked him why he had it, and he told me she'd left it with him once, as a gesture of trust. He said it was a kind of promise he'd made to her.
Fool closed his hand.
Come here, he said.
Later that night, he dressed, and took the false keys and folded himself through the window, while Charlotte held the sash for him. He crept along the roofline, and dropped to a rain barrel in the alley, keeping to shadow. He let himself into the post office, and stood just within the door, listening, and then he locked the door behind him. Behind the counter, he approached the safe for registered packages. Through the front window, a faint greyness drifted in, a different shade of darkness. The safe was a modern cast-iron one built by a respected firm in Baltimore, and Fool knew the make well. He had it open in under 5 minutes, and then he sat a moment on his knees, with his hands in his lap, peering in at the shelves there. He was thinking of Charlotte. He understood she had already said her farewell. How strange the morning would feel, with her gone, and the sun rising as it would over any dawn, the red clouds smouldering out across the sky. There came a sound of footsteps, and then a rattle, as a hand tried the door, and then boots receding along the boardwalk. The night watchman on his rounds. He did not wait long. He took out the 3 black felt bags, and inspected each one, and then, for good measure, removed the small amount of money and government bills from the filing shelf of the safe. Then he closed and spun the latch, locked the building behind him, and climbed lightly back across the roofline to the hotel. In the morning, her trunks were gone. The swag lay tamped safely deep in his pillowcase, and had not been tampered with. He lay a long time in that bed, staring up at the ceiling mouldings. He kept expecting the door to open, her to lift the sheet and slip her cool legs into bed beside him. After a while, he heard men shouting along the boardwalks, the sound of running feet, then horses moving at speed up and down the roadbed. A police whistle sounded. He rose and wrapped himself in the sheet and went to the window. The sky was washed pink, the cold rooftops of the city steaming in the early heat. The harbour waters were all shadow and still, as if the night were coalesced there and sinking deeper. Men in red uniforms were gathered outside the post office, and the assistant postmaster, with his hair disheveled, was ducking through the door. He turned away. In the sunlight on the bureau, he found her opal brooch. He picked it up. It felt warm. He stood there in the rising of the sun at the bottom of the world, and he held it in his fist, as if it were her hand, and the heat of it her own. The Woman in the Thames, Part 2, 1885, London. 7. Adam Fool stood shivering on her doorstep in Hampstead, his fists full of irises wilting in the drizzle. He looked at the police inspector and he looked away.
You would be, sir, an associate of Miss Ricketts?
No, he would not. He could hear the cabby's mare shake her head at the curb and stamp a nailed hoof, and he took off his top hat and felt the cold mist in his hair, and he put it back on. He could not clear his head.
How long have you known the lady in question?
Knowing is such a complicated business. As is the heart. As is the heart. Fool stumbled back, glanced up, nodded politely.
I regret to inform you, sir, her body was recovered 3 days ago at...
Yes?
We're not at liberty to...
Yes.
He felt a hard anger, like a knuckle in his ribs, and understood he must hold on to whatever that was. He did not step into the house, but turned, hearing his shoe scrape on the desolate stones, and at the curb he climbed unseeing into the cab. She was no longer young. That was his first thought. Then, there has been a mistake. If I had returned a week sooner, she might still be. He remembered the white curve of the African sun like an exquisite scythe on her arm in the furrowed bedsheets, the pale hairs on her leg, glistening with sweat, the languorous whoop of the wooden fan turning its blades in the high ceiling, and the slatted windows, the hot dust of the street. The hansom jerked into motion, a shiver of reins in the cold, the mare skidding sharply, then going on. He had not spoken with her in 10 years, true, but he had watched her at a remove, had followed and been informed of her goings-on. For 6 years the attorney Utterson had written with news of her takings, while Fool's purse permitted it, and he had paid the man well for his words. Utterson was sly and troubling, both, but somehow too a kind of friend, and despite Flood's warnings, Fool had found, as the years went on, that he came to almost trust the man. Through Utterson he had heard of Charlotte's affair with a banker in Lisbon, and when it had soured, he had gone to that city, and in October of that year conducted a risky and ambitious heist of bonds, meant to ruin the man's reputation. But instead of selling the bonds back at a profit, he had surprised himself, and Flood both, by burning them in a grate while the big man knocked over the furniture in frustration. It was always so. Would always be. Through Utterson, too, he learned of her grift in San Francisco, in 1879, a haul of some $50,000. That was when he had understood she was a talent to be reckoned with, and when, a few days later, he learned she had married a man to pull it off, he had gone into a week-long rage that even Flood had not dared to interrupt. Through all of this, he had watched and listened, but never once approached her, and he had found, as the years passed, that he did not want to do so. Still, he would hear that she was in London and go through the streets with one eye open for her drifting figure. Had he thought of her less as the years passed? Each September, on the anniversary of their Port Elizabeth heist, he would purchase a clutch of irises and walk down to the Thames and stand alone, remembering. And then he would let the fistful fall and watch their stems separate and their petals drift and fill with water and sink. Her earliest memory had been of water. That is what she told him. Of water warm and silvered in some sunlit green place. Water pouring gentle from her mother's opened fingers. He thought it strange that this should come to him now. Before her mother had died, before Charlotte had been sent down to the workhouse, she and her mother used to walk in Hyde Park in the summer during church hours, and sit on the bank of the lake and watch the swans glide past. That is how she remembered it. She must have been 4, 5 years old. The carved white marble of the swans, and the luminous white shine of her mother's face in the sun. It was a momentary happiness she would carry with her for years, and Fool had listened to her tell him this, while a sadness ate and ate at his heart. They had been seated at an outdoor table, licking flavored ices in the shade of Port Elizabeth's railway station, and he had asked her in a hesitant voice about her years in the Whitechapel workhouse. She said all that was another lifetime. She said she had been 6 when her mother died, and 2 weeks after her body was carted to the mortuary, Charlotte found herself delivered perfunctorily to the workhouse gates by a Ladies' Aid Society member. That lady wore soft white gloves, Charlotte told him, an expensive green hat, a pitying smile. They had stopped in at a bakery around the corner, and Charlotte was still clutching the warm bread roll given her. Then a matron came out, a thick-set woman with red freckled arms, and she pocketed the warm roll into her own skirts and steered Charlotte down a long hall and through an office and down a second hall. Charlotte, without expression, told Fool how she was stripped by the matron,
doused by buckets of cold water, scrubbed raw with carbolic and a horse brush.
That was the beginning of my second life, she said.
She slept in a long room with toughened girls four to a bed, and in the night, under their creaking and coughing, would come the scratch of the rats among their shoes and kicked-off blankets. Someone was always ill, she said. A fever would cut from one end of the ward to the other each winter, and then begin its way back along the rows come spring. Days were filled pricking out oakum with a spike, while a matron read aloud from the Bible, and meals were endured in silence. And that was their true education. The girls were belted on the backs of their hands for infractions, locked in unlighted closets under the stairs. Some nights they were awakened and forced to walk, single file, with wicker baskets balanced on their heads, and should any stumble, all were beaten. In the yard during exercise they would stand some days with their foreheads pressed to the cold bars of the fence, staring out at the world in its passing.
We were all of us waiting, she said, for whatever came next.
Couldn't you have left? He had asked.
Many did.
But then your uncle came.
Then my uncle came,
she nodded.
Yes.
By late afternoon the light had snuffed slowly out, as if a fist were closing over the sun, and Fool felt himself borne aloft into a murky orange darkness. He recalled passing the toll booth, handing the 3 pennies around to the driver's hand with a dread growing in him. He recalled the lakes of muck in the streets, the deep, slow pushing through of the wheels in the water, the cold rub of the leather seat under him. In Bond Street, carriages banged up against each other, and he saw an old woman struck into the mud as the fog came on. It was not nightfall. He had forgotten about them, these London particulars. Fogs that came on without warning, thick as night, brown and choking. Gaslights burned weakly in the shop fronts. Fool climbed down from the hansom on Piccadilly, stood shivering at the curb. He could not catch his breath. There were link boys in the streets carrying torches to see their way, and they moved like faint red horrors through the mists. He fumbled along the shop fronts, losing his footing on the tin cans of a milk woman huddled out of the way. He could hear the grind and sizzle of a hot potato stand nearby, and smelled the roasting chestnuts there, but did not see it. When he held his gloved hand up before his face, it looked ghostly in the haze. He coughed and stumbled on. How long did he wander? He felt something squelch underfoot, and then a clattering roar whooshed past, then brown fog. Then he was leaning against a lamppost as a gaslighter, in a rubberized cloak, banged his lather against the crossbar.
Get off with you,
he muttered, then fog again. Some figure knocked him roughly down, ran past. He was uncertain which street he had turned up. He paused, understanding he must find some place to wait the fog out. At a broad stone stair he turned, and descended, the granite balustrade brushing his gloved fingers. He found himself blinking in the sudden warmth of an art gallery. Women in elegant frocks, seated at the far wall, drank from bone china, and men in waterproofed coats leaned on their sticks at the tea counter, and because he could not bear the lilt in their voices, he turned and passed a watchman, and went in among the paintings. Later, much later, he would wonder at the unlikeliness of finding it. Such a painting, at such a time. He would wonder had he read about it in the Times, perhaps, on that journey to London, or overheard some rumour in the streets. He had no recollection of paying the entrance fee, though he must have done so. He remembered walking, yes, as if borne along by some current of light. He remembered the feeling of being not right in his skin. Everywhere were crowds murmuring amongst themselves, ladies in their kid gloves, gentlemen in their brush top hats. He slipped into a secondary gallery and crossed the room, and without pause, as if drawn to the thing, he went towards one wall where the crowds had gathered thickest. A window overlooked the street, and the orange fog moved down below him, and the lamplight in the room fell leached and sickly across the waxed floorboards, and it seemed to him that a hush had settled over everything. He was aware of the blood in his head. He stood jostled and lonely, staring at the people around him, and then the crowd seemed to part before him, and he stepped forward in his grief, and he lifted his eyes and he saw the painting. Charlotte. He stepped forward, the blood thick in his ears. Of course, it was not of her. He knew this, seeing the crust of yellow paint where a brush or palette knife had streaked her throat, the wash of blurred soot where her hair was lost to the gloom. As he leaned forward, he could see the red underpainting around her eyes, its eerie shadow like a world just beyond the visible. He had not lived his life by art, but he felt the goose flesh rise on his neck, his arms. The woman in the painting stared out at him with Charlotte's face, Charlotte's eyes, in a haze as if through some atmospheric disturbance, her hair a bleed of color, her face lowered. Her stare was lifted and sharp and held his in a harsh vortex of silence, as if she were waiting for him to speak some answer of great moment. But it was an answer to a question left unspoken, and to which he could say nothing, only nod miserably, and turn, it seemed, always away. He had all those years ago, in Brindisi, failed her. That was the truth of it. He had left Port Elizabeth 3 weeks after the heist, and journeyed north, overland, into Africa, the uncut diamonds hidden under a false panel in his trunk. He had filled that trunk with ostrich feathers, and taken the slower eastern route, cautious, thinking of Charlotte as he went. She would be waiting for him in Brindisi before the month was out, and it was her he moved towards. Then he got sick. At Maputo he understood he could not go on, and he risked a berth in a Belgian trader sailing north along the coast past Zanzibar. In Djibouti, he found passage to Italy. By the time he was offloading in Brindisi, he was so weak he could hardly stand. He had been traveling almost 7 weeks. He had made his rendezvous on time, but Charlotte was not at the Adelphi when he drifted, feverish, in. He feared something had happened to her. He made inquiries in his broken French, but no one had seen her. Nor was there any packet of money waiting, a telegram, anything. Fool, in his sickness, understood Martin Reckitt had learned of their tryst and kept her from him. The diamonds, all of it. He was light-headed, starving. He had neither shaved nor washed in a long time. The hotel bill rose. He sent a confused telegram to Flood in London, but wrote out the wrong address, and it never arrived. The weeks passed. One day, as he stumbled through the port on his way to the customs house, he collapsed against a pillar and could not get up. In the sun, the marble was hot on his neck, the sky very blue. There were dogs and donkeys and carts pushing through the crowds. It was then he felt a hand on his shoulder, and through the haze of his fever, he looked up and saw Martin Reckitt. It was no dream. The old thief took him in his arms and supported him, and led him to his hotel. Reckitt nursed Fool back to strength. On the second day, Reckitt picked up the diamonds in their black felt bags from the customs house where Fool had stashed them. Still he stayed, fed him, washed him, sat with him in that miserable blank hotel room with his shirt off in the heat, and squeezed a rag of water at Fool's lips when he could not drink, murmuring the while about trust and betrayal and the seducing of his niece. He should have slit Fool's throat. He should have left Fool in an alley to rot. Reckitt had been a priest, or almost a priest once, and perhaps there was some last grudging mercy in him as he saved Fool's life. Fool would remember little of that time. He would remember asking after Charlotte. Was she ill, also? Was she in some trouble? Had the Boers interrogated her in Cape Town? Reckitt had leaned over him in the wavering heat, his skin flushed. Charlotte's in England, Mr. Fool. She's well enough. Reckitt poured out a glass of water. I take it she never told you. He struggled to rise.
Told me what?
A viciousness in the old thief's eye. She's to be married. In the new year. Fool fell back, tried to speak, slept again. In the morning, when Fool opened his eyes, Reckitt had taken the diamonds and settled the hotel bill and disappeared. There was no farewell. That day at noon, the hotel staff turned Fool out into the street, still weak, not a shilling to his name. Reckitt was already sailing for England, already sailing towards his own fate, the diamonds discovered in his luggage, the old thief apprehended and condemned to 20 years in Millbank. But on that first night after Reckitt's departure, Fool had sat shivering under the broken column marking the end of the Via Appia, knowing none of that yet, confused, hurt, peering uphill at the lone cafe still open until the lights were snuffed, and then wandering down among the small fishing boats overturned along the beach, the sand cold and hard-packed under his feet. In the morning he had trudged up to the steamship offices and watched the young clerk open for the day, but something had held him back. He did not go in. Instead, he had gone in and out of artisan shops, while musicians piped faintly down through the narrow, crooked streets, eating the cold, folded pastries the old men threw out by the dozen at the end of each day, thinking, crazily, that if he waited long enough, Charlotte just might come to him. It made no sense. But somewhere that mercurial creature he had fallen in love with was moving through the world, in counterpoint to him, and he could not accept that the future he had imagined, throughout his long, dusty overland trek through Africa, fevered, dreaming of their nights in Port Elizabeth, was no longer possible. His own earliest memory was not of water, but fire. Perched in an underground room on a cracked axlewood table, small legs hanging over the edge into emptiness, shirt unbuttoned while a huge fire whooshed and crackled behind him, the glow of the flames gleaming in the polished wood. There was a man with discs in front of his eyes, and these discs burned with the flames also. He knew his father stood somewhere in the shadow, but he would not approach, though fool cried. The man before him was bald, and his four front teeth were gold, and a sheen of sweat stood out on his flickering brow as he leaned in, pressed his ear to the boy's chest, tapped two icy fingers on his back. In his other hand, a scalpel glinted, and the man looked at fool and asked where it hurt. He would remember that fear, the absolute certainty of it, like a thing he could hold on to and slip in a pocket. There was a dish with smears of rice paste half visible beside his thigh. The man said to him, "I should just cut it out of you, no? And be done with it, no?" He held the scalpel between his thumb and forefinger, the way fool had seen adults hold writing utensils, and this somehow frightened him more. The man said, "I can hear it in your chest, bully. Right there." And he tapped fool once over the heart. And all at once he could feel it too. And though he did not know what it was, he would imagine it there for years. Alive, writhing in him, its little jaws working, eating his life from the inside out. 8. On the third afternoon, when the fog had thinned but not yet lifted, William Pinkerton went back to Blackfriars. He stood with a hand at the railing where Charlotte Reckitt had fallen. He crouched low in the muck and studied the bollards. He leaned out over the span in the high, cold air, seeking some evidence of her escape. A tangle of clothing, a scrabbling of mud on a stone. Anything. He could feel the hems of his trousers clinging in a cold, wet crust to his ankles, and he would stop now and then and shake out a leg, not caring how it must look. Then he would move a few feet farther along the bridge, the grey street slime squelching under his boots. The river was high and the colour of burnt cork, and he watched the steamer ferries vanish through the fog. A notion was forming in his mind that he could not shake. He knew Charlotte Reckitt's body lay in pieces on Frith Street, and yet he knew too that a man saw only what he looked for, and he scowled and stared out at the drifting fog, but could not make sense of it. "The hell with it," he told himself. The woman was dead. Curling his bruised hand into a fist as he did so. What was it had happened? He stood in the chill, struggling to remember, passing a sore hand across his eyes in the afternoon light. The night had been cold. He had felt the frost on the bridge sets under his shoes, the slide and rasp of it. He remembered there had been night watchmen blowing their whistles somewhere behind him, but he had not known if they were pursuing him or Charlotte Reckitt or some other. He remembered Charlotte across the footway, running for the railing, climbing high upon it and turning to glare back at him, breathless. The wind crackling her skirts whitely out from under her coat, the shape of her boots, a flash of stockinged ankles. Her hair in her eyes so that he could not make out her expression. He had lunged towards her and she had let go with her fingers and leaned back into the darkness with the shell of one ear visible and plunged straight backed with arms outspread. And then, like that, she was gone. He awoke the next day before dawn with a fierce ache blooming behind his left eye, like a sunrise of blood, and the pain worsened in the bad air. He dressed with one hand on the towel rail to steady himself, and went down for a breakfast of rashers and eggs and 2 cups of strong black tea, without lifting his head to the day. Then paid and went out into the street and hailed a hansom for the wet docks at Wapping in the jostle and crush of the morning hire. The day was a thin fog, a greying of the light as if tinted by a fine dusting of coal, and he turned up the collar of his topcoat. The hansom rattled on. Wapping was grim with its accidental courtyards and crooked alleyside shops. A stink of tan, tallow, gutted fish, rotting vegetable peelings oozed up from the open gutters. He saw windows packed with brass sextants and chronometers, sailors' compasses held open with their small paper tags dangling dustily in the cases, sailmakers by the dozen with ropes and lines of tar coiled on tables, and at each corner the slop sellers with their hammocks and oiled wet coats and red or blue flannels knotted and swaying in the doorframes. Wagons rolled past, loaded with reeking mounds of pure. In the crowds, newsboys were hollering out word of the Fenian bombing from the day before, and he heard the driver in back clear his throat and spit and snort and vacate his nostrils.
"Transport the lot of them," the driver hollered at him. "Australia ain't too rough for their like."
William said nothing. The driver said some word more that he did not catch, then creaked back on his bench. He rubbed 2 fingers at his temple to ease the ache. He saw girls in the streets, bareheaded and leering, never mind the hour, and sailors in loose jackets and pantaloons. There were customs officers in brass buttons and blue coats, and inked sailors with hoops in their ears, and others with coloured wrappings on their heads. Wiry boys slipped barefoot between the carts, despite the cold, lifting what little they could. When the hansom had come to a halt, William got down and the driver gestured with his whip to the south, to the tall iron gates of the London docks, standing wide there. He could see masts by the hundreds rising in the grey beyond, like the stark spines of some ravaged forest.
1 and 6, the driver grunted.
William looked at him. His voice was soft.
"How much, again?"
The driver cleared his throat, squinted up at the sky as if anxious for rain.
"Call it 1 shilling, he said. "Special light for you, sir."
William nodded. He gave the man 1 and 2.
"For your trouble," he said.
More and more often now, William stared into mirrors, and his father stared back. Never mind his father had stood barely 5'8" in stocking feet, and at 40 weighed 165 pounds to William's 225. Never mind his ape-like arms that dangled near to his knees. For his father too could wrap himself round a barrel of molasses and lift it 4 feet onto a flatbed without strain. William remembered how the old man would oil his hair flat, and how, in July, the heat would stand it out upon his skull in thick black curls. Scottish to a fault. He scorned anything not seen with his own eyes, not weighed in his own fist, or poured through his fingers. He drank 8 glasses of water a day and forced the same upon his family. Never touched a drop of liquor, not even cold ale in high summer. Ate potatoes in their jackets with relish. For 13 years he drove his children 17 miles to church over dirt roads, with his back rigid and his face unsmiling. But one Sunday, when the pastor spoke in defense of slavery, he stood up and put on his hat and walked out, and he did not ever go back. William feared him and loved him and loathed him every day of his life. Yet, too, not a day passed that he did not want to be him. His father was not a man of great physical beauty, but the conviction in his fists could sway any man living. He had been a cooper when he came to America, and then a lawman. And when he set out as a private detective, there was no such thing anywhere in the country, and he became something else entire, a thing unstoppable and elemental and terrifying. He woke throughout his life to a recurring illness which left a smell of burning in his nostrils. On such mornings, he would squint out at the world under blood-coloured eyelids, and speak to no one. The Scot in him distrusted doctors. The frontiersman in him blended his own medicinal drinks. Myrtleberry, celery, radishes, warmed milk, other fouler beverages. His beard he would trim with a pair of barber's shears, kept handles out in a mason jar on a shelf near the rain barrel. Beside the barn, a piece of mirror had been fastened with rope and nail, and he would wash himself there in any weather for modesty. He slept when it grew dark and rose when it grew light, and walked his daily constitutional come snow or shine. In the unheated house, when the door banged shut, William would kick off his sheets, shake his younger brother awake, and together they would start their chores. If there was a vanity in his father, then it came from a love of what physical power could do. He had trained under a pugilist in the Glasgow slums, and he took William on his 8th birthday to a warehouse on the Chicago docks to see Tom Heenan fight Johnny Roberts. Heenan was the taller, but young still at that time, and not yet a champion, and when he struck Roberts down in 4, the riled crowd stormed the ring with knives and chains. William's father had held him against the far wall and insisted he watch the brawl. "It's never what happens, lad," his father had murmured. "Watch now. It's who it happens to. That's what matters." His father spoke little about his own blood. He left it for his wife to sing Scottish ballads in the evenings with a misty eye. He did not believe in looking backward, and took what he could from his life at hand, and leaned knife-like into the future with it. But one afternoon when William was 9, he spoke about his own father, dead in Glasgow. They were standing in the unscythed grass behind the woodshed. He said his father, William's grandfather, and all 6 of his own great-uncles had eyes the silver of cooling iron, and that such eyes in the Scotland of his youth were believed the eyes of ancient Highland warriors, eyes born with brutality in them, or so legend claimed. Those men had been blacksmiths each, and as if to prove the legend true, each had killed a man in a bare-knuckle fight before his 18th year. The English had killed them all, one way or another. William had brushed his own face in wonder. "Do I have eyes like that too, Pa?" "You," his father had grunted, "you take after your mother." As he approached the gates of the dockworks, he could hear it. A roaring, muffled and thrumming up through the cobblestones like some vast machinery at work deep in the earth. Then he came around a corner and saw them. Hundreds of men, blowing on their fingers, stamping their feet for the cold. Constables with truncheons and dock officers with their red hands bared kept back the crowds with a lazy swing of their arms, and the labourers lingered in ragged shirts and coats, smoking, sullen, gaunt, unwashed and reeking, their fists plunged down the fronts of their trousers for warmth. It was only just 7:30, and all at once there was a ripple in the throng as faces were raised, listening, and then the great iron gates screeled open, and there came a pouring of men through, shoulder to shoulder, the breath steaming off them like cattle driven to some enclosure beyond. He could hear the 4 men on their platforms crying the names of men like a blessing, and he could see the haggard and the lost of that city hollering and waving and showing the whites of their eyes in their desperation to be hired. Somewhere in all that stood the Irishman Malone, who had found Charlotte Reckitt's head. William gripped his wallet in one fist, swore softly at the futility of ever finding the man. Then he went down into it. A world all its own in its breaking. Slowly he went from basin to basin along the quays, the ships in their locks raised to differing heights. He could see the green copper sheathing of an American schooner with its weeds and barnacles looming high above him and creaking in the faint breeze, and at its stern he saw a goat tethered and bleating, and he could see beyond that the line of planks and gangways stretching from ship to ship along that basin. Other vessels drifted low under his eyeline, and ladders leaned up against the edges of the stonework, where dark-skinned sailors ascended in weary single file. He could see a heavy sack of meal, misshapen and twisting sluggishly on its chains above a quay, like a hanged man in his hood, and he watched a thresher guide the burlap by its base as if to hold the ankles of the dead steady. He could smell the open crates of fish in their glister, and the reek of bundled tobacco mingling with the cinnamon and rum. He passed a box of open horns and ivory, with the flesh tufted and rotting at the bases, and the stink of it made his eyes water. His soles stuck to and peeled from the slatted boards of the wharf, and he realized it was old sugar spilled from the sheds nearby. and he walked on, his steps blatting and slapping messily in the cold, blinking and shivering and wondering if he was coming down with something. He passed through the warehouses, the low sheds with their vast grinding wheels turning through their roofs like paddle steamers on the Mississippi, the brown water turning lazily under their laden barges, and he wended his way through the crates of cork, the bins of raw sulphur. The rattle of empty casks rolled along the cobbles, the clatter and hiss of chains slung up in a spray from the river, the brassy hammering of coopers at their barrels. He passed down into the storehouse vaults with their foul, moulding dry rot and their spilled wine, where orange lanterns smouldered on iron rings. And then he ascended through the far tunnels, and everywhere he walked, men regarded him uneasily, but did not slow at their labours. And at each basin he stopped and asked, but no man had word of the one he sought. At last one foreman did not turn from his query, but spat a slick of tobacco onto the wharf and stood waiting. William watched it bubble there like a dripping of grease. The ache in his skull beetled deeper. The man's crew was unloading a collier moored to a rickety dolphin a little ways out in the river, and he watched the whippers in their black, stained greatcoats and fustians bend and hoist along the ladders.
Who? Malone.
The foreman smeared a wrist across his forehead.
There's a Malloy works for us sometimes. Skinny little fella, big hands, Irish. No lighterman, though. He's a lumper in the right season.
Was he unloading a cargo of bulbs last Friday? The foreman shrugged, rolled the wad of tobacco from cheek to cheek.
It's about the head.
What head?
Wasn't there a woman's head pulled out on Friday? I reckon I'd remember it.
William frowned.
You didn't find part of a dead woman here Friday?
Oh, we got lots of stiffs round there.
He grinned, but they all swear they're here to work.
William smiled.
Listen, I'll tell the lads to roll the bug logs back out into the river. It's just too much bleeding fuss when you drag one up. You'll be at it all day.
Bug logs? The foreman squinched up one eye, spat again.
Are there any other docks would have been unloading cargoes of bulbs that day? I don't keep the manifests, do I?
Of course not, no.
Look at them buggers, he muttered.
He nodded at a group of labourers leaning against a post where an unlit cauldron twisted and untwisted on its chains.
Like they ain't even here. Ain't much to pick from in the morning. You just go down to the Bird and Whistle and hire the first damned butcher or old soldier from the Crimea you can find. Be lucky to catch a clerk or an old servant, anyone wants the work. It don't take no skill, but aught you can pick up a heavy and get from one side to the other. Pick it up now, darlings, he hollered. Go on, get your skirts dirty.
A ducking of heads, a sudden scrambling.
They ain't all worthless, he said, but nearly.
William nodded. She's adrift, he said, nodding at the collier.
Aye, she's cranky. Like to get worse before she stiffens.
The foreman did not offer his hand as he moved away, but after a moment paused and called back over one shoulder.
You could try it at St. Catherine, he said. That's just bloody crazy enough to be tooling a jewel's head from the waters.
William tipped his hat, but the man was already lost in the roar. This is what he wanted to ask. Where was it pulled out? How did it appear to the eye? Was it bundled and tied or no? How long had it sat unwrapped in the close air of the docks, and who had touched it, and who had not? Was there any other cloth swaddling it? Did anything fall from the package as it was lifted out? Where was the boat hook that took it? Why haul it out at all, and not pole it back into the river? What of the currents, and where was the likely drift of it from? How many other dead had been found that week, that month, that year? What of the woman's hair?
Yes.
What of her hair?
Oh, and who was the bastard pulled her, and where did he live?
Scotland Yard's offices on the old palace grounds at 4 Whitehall Place had spread like a cancer until they had taken over the surrounding buildings and carriage houses, numbers 3 and 5, 21 and 22, and still there was not enough room. William's father had told him of a time when the old building had dwarfed its purposes, but William could not imagine it. The public entrance was at the rear, and he came in off the narrow cobbled street of Great Scotland Yard, shrugging the cold from his neck. At the back hall sergeant's desk he stopped, waited, announced himself. It was a tall, angled drafting desk on a dais with a leather-bound records book laid out upon it, and the hall sergeant perched behind it, high on his backless stool, a pencil in one hand, and his other pressed flat on one knee. The man was a stout, rough-hewn veteran of the force, with a powerful neck and a grey walrus moustache that lent him an air of thuggish dignity. The second finger of his right hand looked to have been broken and reset badly many years ago. William asked for John Shaw, and the sergeant eyed him where he stood, grizzled and hatless, stinking yet of the dockyards, then leaned out and seized a runner by the scruff of his neck as he went past.
"Take this here gent up to John Blunt's office, lad," he said. "Mind you be quick about it. We don't get so many American detectives, we can afford to be rough with them."
William grimaced. His head was aching, and he closed his eyes momentarily.
"I'm here to see Shaw, not Blunt."
"Aye," the sergeant nodded irritably. "I know the man you want. Go on."
The runner ascended the stairs to the offices, and William followed, surprised by the stiffness in his bad leg. Shaw's office was a cramped, low-ceilinged room, cluttered with a black walnut bookshelf and twin bulleted armchairs, and the chief inspector's desk filling the whole of the back quarter. A high window filtered in some light, and he saw Inspector Blackwell there, next to the curtains, hair slicked, clothes smelling of peppermint. Shaw half stood in greeting.
"A better morning, Mr. Blunt," William said.
Shaw smiled wearily.
"It's a nickname. A compliment, I take it. They always are."
Shaw sat back, round-shouldered and red-faced in his rumpled waistcoat. His shirt sleeves were rolled, and he did not trouble to make himself presentable. He wore wire spectacles low on the bridge of his nose, and he peered over the tops of them, and then back down at his desk. There were boxes of files and reports strewn about the floor, and William lifted a lidded box from one of the two leather chairs and set it at his feet and sat down uninvited. The chief inspector ran a harried knuckle under his chin.
"These bloody Fenians.
Tell me how blowing up the underground helps to free the Irish from their English masters. Tell me what this poor flat had to do with it."
He crackled a report across the desk, and William took it from him without seeing. Shaw unhooked the wire spectacles from his red ears.
"He was a haberdasher, for God's sake, on his way to work."
"A haberdasher? Some threat to the free Irish." After a moment, William said,
"My father fled Edinburgh to get away from you English. He used to say you can go in the harness or holding the reins, and both are aimed in the same direction. But which one would you rather?" "Your father was a wise man."
William frowned slightly. Somehow Shaw saying it made him bristle.
"The Fenian business has been going on a while, I take it,"
he said, changing the subject.
"Aye, we're under an awful pressure. The Home Office wants this ended. Gladstone wants this ended. We'll tear them out by the root."
He blinked and regarded William and frowned.
"What are you doing here?"
"I've been out at the docks."
"No, Malone." Shaw sighed and leaned back in his seat and set a quiet hand on the papers before him. He looked at Blackwell and back at William.
"Dr. Breck should be here shortly," he said. "He's been occupied with this mess at Gower Street. But you can ask him about your Charlotte racket."
"I will."
The sacking her torso was found in might provide some direction.
"The sacking, aye."
Blackwell cleared his throat. He stood profiled at the window as if posing for a portrait.
"Maria Martin cut her hair when she went out to meet Corder, sir, to disguise herself."
"Maria Martin," William said. "Is this a recent case?"
Shaw grunted.
"Maria Martin was murdered by the Red Barn butcher. That was 50 years ago."
William shook his head.
"I guess we can rule him out then."
Shaw had opened a box of loose tobacco as they spoke and began to fill his pipe. William could see the red locomotive painted on the underlid, and he watched as the chief turned the stem in his fingers and studied it, as if thinking better of it, then stuffed it back into his pocket with one hand and closed the lid of the box with the other.
This was back in the days of Jack Ketch,
he was saying, before there even was a police to speak of. Corder was a wealthy farmer who had got Miss Martin in trouble. He lured her out to a barn one night and stabbed her twice and shot her through the eye for good measure, and then buried her there, in a shallow grave. Went off into the provinces and wrote her parents for a year or so, pretending she had eloped with him. Story goes, Martin's mother had a dream her daughter had been murdered, and Martin's father went out to the barn and poked about in the dirt with a rake and pulled up something black and rotten, and that was his daughter. I guess Corder was hanged for it. Shaw opened his hands in a rueful gesture. Afterwards they cut him up in the lecturing halls, and bits of him were sold all over the country. A leather seller in Oxford Street still has his scalp on display in a pickling jar. I'd like to see that. I remind you of back home, I guess. Well, we like to keep our pickled scalps in the parlour. Shaw laughed. What can you do? He said. It's the modern world. There was an abrupt knock at the door. Come, Shaw barked. A man came in, leaning on a gold-tipped walking stick, his torso thin and hard like an old-fashioned scythe. He wore a sleek silk hat with a wide brim that darkened his spectacles into discs of shadow and wire, and cast a strange, crooked line to his nose. A purple cravat hung in a tangle off his collar, where the tie-pin had been stabbed at a crazy angle. William watched his head sway at the end of his neck, snake-like and grotesque.
Ah, Dr. Breck, Shaw said.
He rose in greeting from behind his desk. You will have heard of Mr. Pinkerton out of Chicago.
Mr. Pinkerton, Dr. Breck. You know Mr. Blackwell.
William stood. The doctor's fingers were red and sore-looking, as if accustomed to labouring without gloves on chemical tinctures, his nails edged in grime. His hand felt warm in William's own, and it was withdrawn at once as if the touch of the living sickened him.
Doctor, William said. He hooked a thumb into his waistcoat. Mr. Shaw tells me you have inspected the head.
Breck scowled at Shaw.
He means the one from the river.
Is there another?
William asked.
More than you can imagine, sir,
Breck said sourly, turning to him. He let go of his cane and removed his eyeglasses and withdrew a handkerchief from his vest pocket and proceeded to polish the lenses.
It wasn't as cruel as it might have been, he said.
William thought about this a moment.
She was dead before she was decapitated.
Correct. Her arms were tied.
Who told you that, Mr. Pinkerton?
Mr. Pinkerton has several theories, Dr. Brank,
Shaw said. He came with me to view the head and torso.
He's only just putting it together now, sir,
Blackwell said.
Breck scowled. In life, the victim would have stood approximately 5 feet 4 inches tall, he said. She was black-haired. She had not eaten in several days. There is bruising to her arms as if she had been handled roughly. Tied up, most likely. The stab wounds on the torso do not appear to have been executed in a passion. They are very deliberate, very shallow, and clean, as if the body did not twist at all as the blade was removed. The blade used was single-sided and curved slightly. The knife wounds are not deep enough to be the cause of death, and the victim's lack of movement is consistent with the poison found in the body. She would not have been conscious at the time.
Shaw grunted.
Poison, you say?
Arsenic? William asked.
Always with you Americans, it's arsenic,
Breck muttered.
No, chloroform.
She was drugged, then,
Shaw said slowly.
Drugged, then tied up, stabbed, decapitated, and her body left in several places around the city. Is that what you're telling us, Doctor?
It's damned elaborate, William muttered.
Rather too elaborate. The facts are what they are. I simply report them.
But how they're read and understood is a different matter, William said.
So, she was drugged in order to subdue her, presumably. Why then tie her up?
They must have expected her to wake up.
Except she did not. She was stabbed while unconscious.
Too much chloroform, said Shaw. Can that kill a person?
It would seem so.
Breck clutched the head of his walking stick with both hands.
Why so many stab wounds? Shaw asked, if she was unconscious and not struggling.
How many stab wounds were there, Doctor?
Two to the upper left arm,
three to the torso, one near the heart. The angle of all of the wounds is from below, which is commensurate with a taller assailant stabbing at her underhanded. William considered this. What was she tied to? Not a chair. Could she have been tied upright to a post? The angle you're describing would mean she would have had to be high enough in relation to her attacker. A chair is unlikely, Breck interrupted, unless it was on some sort of platform, or unless the assailant was a rather small person. A woman, for instance. Shaw looked offended. A woman wouldn't do such a thing. I'd still like to know, William said, why so many of these shallow cuts. A weak assailant, Shaw suggested, or timid, maybe? Maybe it was their first time.
It was to wake her up, sir,
Blackwell said quietly. The men fell silent. William studied the young inspector, ran a hand over his jaw.
If she was dragged and tied up, sir, the shallow cuts would be to wake her up.
Interesting, said William. So they didn't want to kill her. Or not right away.
Perhaps they wanted information, sir,
Blackwell went on.
You said she had her share of bad dealings.
I said she was part of the swell mob, William said. I don't know what kind of enemies she had. Breck was already shifting his weight as if to leave. A moment, doctor, William said. Are you familiar with Bertillon's methods? Breck regarded William with displeasure.
I know, Monsieur Bertillon, yes, and his theories. We communicated together on a case last spring.
If you would take the woman's measurements...
It is, of course, difficult without all of the pieces, Mr. Pinkerton, but I have already done so, as much as I can.
I'd like a copy of that sent to the Chicago office, William said. I'll have an operative go through our records, see if anything turns up with an alias attached.
It is the property of Scotland Yard, not me.
Send your results to me, Dr. Breck, said Shaw. I'll see that they get to Chicago, William.
Now, Doctor... The bombing.
The doctor wrung his soft hands, unperturbed.
If you bring me a body, I will look at it. I can do nothing with a bucket of bits.
You have what we have, Shaw said. Breck wet his lips with the nub of a long, pink tongue. He said,
I can tell you that there was a bomb. Your unfortunate haberdasher was standing next to it, or upon it, or perhaps even carrying it. He would have been very close.
Shaw regarded him with evident impatience.
Wonderful.
Mr. Blackwell, Breck said, would you be so good as to take me to the haberdasher's belongings?
One last thing, doctor, William said. Charlotte Reckitt. Was she with child?
Breck paused, his long peeling fingers on the latch of the door.
If she had been pregnant, Mr. Pinkerton, I should have mentioned it. Now, if you gentlemen will excuse me...
The two men left, and Shaw stared at the door after it had shut for a long moment, and then he said in a careful voice,
What do you think of our good doctor?
William shook his head tiredly. Shaw stood and crossed to the sideboard, and withdrew a small silver flask from the cabinet there, and two glasses.
Your father didn't much care for him either, he said. Breck's clever with a corpse, though. He helped us in the Tom's killing last year. A piece of wadding recovered from the body was found to match a broadside in the man's possession. How do you like your whiskey?
In a bottle.
Here's a glass.
Shaw sat back down with a groan.
Mr. Blackwell's reliable, hmm? That's one word for it. He was an amateur boxing champion last year.
Blackwell? I don't believe it.
Aye. You'd never know he was a reader of sensation novels. Penny Dreadfuls. That Wilkie Collins and the like. Desk is full of them. I never could stomach a detective who was a reader.
William turned the glass in his hands, the smoky liquid darkening there. Shaw raised an eyebrow.
What is it?
Charlotte Reckitt has an uncle in Millbank, William said, his smile fading. An ex-priest. I'll want to talk to him, I guess.
Can you arrange it? You want an interview with Martin Reckitt.
Before I leave, yes, William said, just to be certain there's nothing I've overlooked. Maybe he knows something about Charlotte's business, who she worked with. I have a file to close. And then he caught himself and glanced up.
You know the man?
I know the man. Aye.
Well?
Well, nothing. I can't see what Martin Reckitt could offer on this that wouldn't be a lie straight out. Bastard's been locked away for years.
William shifted his bulk in the chair, grinding an elbow into the armrest. His trousers were tight, pinching at his belly.
You never mentioned him, he said, with a slow, quizzical wrinkling of his forehead.
Niece turns up in pieces all over the city, and you never mention you knew her uncle?
Shaw gave him an exasperated look.
The man is in your files, too. There's no conspiracy here. What could he possibly have to do with it?
After a moment, Shaw picked up a small framed photograph and passed it across to William. It was a speckled picture of a little girl in a white dress, standing next to a gravestone, her face serious and unshy, some inscription on the base of the stone that William could not make out.
Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, Shaw recited, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell.
Cheerful, William said.
That's the grave of Fanny Adams. She was murdered 20 years ago, up in Alton, cut up into pieces in a field on a sunny day, and the killer just walked away from it. She was 10 years old.
Jesus, William muttered. What is wrong with this country?
It's a reminder, Shaw said, ignoring the question. Instruments of vengeance, William. That is what we are.
William shifted the photograph from one knee to the other, then set it on the desk in front of him.
Blunt instruments, maybe, he said. Does he know about her death yet?
Who?
For God's sake, Charlotte Reckitt's uncle.
Shaw's chair creaked and thumped as he tucked himself nearer his desk.
You went out to New Street on Friday, he said. What did you find?
When William said nothing, he went on.
Nothing. Because we'd already gone through it all. Because there was nothing there. What happened to Charlotte Reckitt is most likely some kind of revenge killing. Bad people betraying other bad people and suffering for it. Sometimes they do get what they deserve. You should go back to Chicago, William. Go home.
Shaw's florid face turned in the weak light of the window, pausing as if to say something more. He grimaced. Then he said it.
Staying here won't get you any closer to your Edward Shade.
William looked at him sharply.
Edward Shade? You thought I didn't know. You've been into every flash house in London asking questions. You don't make it much of a secret. You've been following me. Please. Nothing so dramatic.
William was leaning forward in his chair, turning the glass in his hands. He said, quietly,
Edward Shade's a ghost, John. He's not real.
Oh, Shade was real. He was real as a bullet.
He died during your civil war. What are you talking about?
Your father never told you.
William could feel the blood rise in his cheeks.
Told me what?
Shaw's thick red fingers were still.
Well, he said, I only know what your father told me.
Shade was an agent for him in the war, a spy. He volunteered to go south to gather information, and something happened. I don't know what. But he was caught. The Confederates tortured him. That was the last your father heard about him. I expect Shade died in a prison or was shot as a spy or such like. I understand some sort of evidence turned up. Something rather compelling. Two graves, one marked with the name of a fellow spy. But then a year or so after the war was finished, your father took to the notion that maybe Shade had survived.
I don't know what changed his mind. I think he wanted Shade to be alive. Wanted to believe he just walked away from the war and disappeared. I guess he never forgave himself for failing the lad.
He never told you about this.
William was shaking his head.
There's a grave.
Why?
In Virginia. Why would my father suddenly think he didn't die? It doesn't make sense. I told him that myself.
William looked at Shaw. There were documents, he said, in a file, in my father's home safe. Records of jobs Shade was involved in, all dated after the war.
Rumors of jobs, you mean? And never any evidence of the men? Am I right?
He frowned.
Go ask old Benjamin Porter if you doubt it, Shaw said with a shrug.
He and Sally were there when Shade crossed the lines. They were the ones he rode out with. They were the last ones to see him alive.
Sally Porter?
Aye, and Benjamin.
I was with Ben in Virginia, he said slowly, in 62.
Shaw regarded him strangely.
Your father had those old porters hunting Shade over here for years. I guess since they knew him by sight, I expect they're both still in the city somewhere.
William rubbed at his face with both hands. He was thinking of Sally Porter in her ruined hovel, how she had said nothing to him of this.
William, you all right?
After a moment he stood and buttoned his Chesterfield and stared down at the chief inspector with a quiet grimness.
Arrange an interview for me with Reckitt's uncle, John, he said. Let me finish this and get back to Chicago. I'm not here to get dragged into anything.
Shaw's small eyes fixed on William's.
I'd say you're already in it, he said.
He came down out of Whitehall with his face grey and his bruised hand trembling. He had known his father as a violence and a scarring that burned coldly in his flesh. The old man's death had taken the shared part of them with it and left William alone in his regret. He could not explain to his wife that he did not know what to do with his memory of the man. It had never been intimacy. His father had run a network of spies throughout the war and shared little of it with his sons. His father had discussed the particulars of Edward Shade with strangers at the yard, and never seen fit to confide in his own blood. William thought of Sally Porter in anger, and then he did not. All he knew of his father's violent past, of his habits, his medical cocktails, of the stories behind each keepsake in the man's rolled-top desk, the grape shot that had been pulled from his father's saddle, the laces that had nearly garroted him in Detroit, the dried daffodils and morning dew pressed in the pages of a Bible carried overseas from Edinburgh, a lifetime gone. All of this, and none, had been the man in his breathing. The death of his father meant William, too, had crossed a threshold. That was the fact of it. It had surprised him. Love was not the word for what he'd felt for his father. He knew some part of his own self lay diminished and mouldering in the wet earth back in Chicago. He pressed his hand against the cold cast iron of a street lamp outside Scotland Yard. He stared out at the fog. 9. William Pinkerton. What was the famed detective's first son but a wisp, a rumour, a creature of nightmare walking the flash world, frightening all? Few had met him who did not count the days in chalk on prison walls, who did not nurse a broken bone. Fool was never among them. He had heard tell of terrible strength, true, of a man who did not sleep for days, who could survive without food or water in the stunted wastes of the Western Territories, driving horse after horse, bridle first, down to dust, who would drift along the water-rotted docks of New York with impunity. The man was 50. No, the man did not age. It was said he could read a lie on a face like wind cutting across a lake. He could crush a pint glass with one squeeze, and his weathered hands not bleed. In Chicago he frequented Madison's Flash House those Fridays when he was in town, and he would go down among the dippers and sharps there, with a wary smile, and stand unmolested at the bar and drink a cider very slowly, watching the flash world all the while watch him back. Some swore he could stare down a bull. Others swore his eyelids had been burned off as a boy, and he did not blink as a consequence. In Virginia he was seen to leap from a moving train carriage onto a horse held up alongside, and to then unsling a rifle and shoot a man down, all before the other could draw. In the Black Hills he had beaten a sheriff into submission with his bare fists, and broken every finger of both hands in the process, and picked up his gun with the soft of his wrists when it was done. Fool had heard it said the only world he hated more than the criminal one was the world of the law, and this was said with a knowing grin always. There were men who said his children were not his own. Others denied this and swore on their poke his brother.